This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at KMJNow.com. Each week, you listen as we visit with veterans of World War II. And the purpose of this program is to, first of all, honor the service and sacrifice that those young men and women, more than 16 million Americans, provided for our country, securing our freedom more than 65 years ago. Also, we, of course, want to preserve their stories for posterity. That is very important. And hopefully along the way, as we relive some of these memories, the rest of us can be inspired by that great legacy that's been given to us by the greatest generation. And I am very excited about the visit we're going to have today with a 93-year-old Navy veteran. That's right, I said 93. And you would never guess if you shook his hand or, better yet, saw him riding his motorcycle around Tulare County. It's Ivanhoe's Merle Twible, who served on a big ship, an aircraft carrier, the preeminent aircraft carrier, the USS Enterprise, and no Star Trek fans, not that Enterprise. The original USS Enterprise was commissioned May 12th, 1938 at Newport News, Virginia. It was the wife of the Secretary of the Navy, Mrs. Claude Swanson, who smashed a bottle of champagne across the Enterprise's bow and said, "May she say with just pride, I have done the state some service." Oh, did she ever. The Big E was an incredible fighting machine for the United States during World War II. Enterprise was the most decorated ship of the war, and in all annals of recorded history, of the 22 major engagements in the Pacific during World War II, the Enterprise participated in 20. The Big E was the only carrier to engage the enemy at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. We will talk to Merle Twible about that. The Enterprise lost 6 planes and 9 men that Sunday morning. The Enterprise suffered 15 direct hits and numerous near misses, causing structural damage throughout the war. And how about this? The Big E was reported to have been sunk 6 times by the Japanese. It was never the truth. The Enterprise spearheaded the first offensive punch of the war, hitting the Marshall Islands and Wake Island and eventually Midway. The Enterprise escorted the Hornet and Colonel Jimmy Doolittle for the Tokyo bombing in April of 1942. It was Enterprise Lieutenant Commander Wade McCluskey who located the Japanese carriers at Midway, where, of course, dive bombers from the Big E sank the Kaga and the Akagi, while Yorktown sank the Soryu. After the Yorktown was put out of action, her planes joined the Big E's planes. Together, they sank a 4th carrier, Hiryu, and those were 4 of the 6 Japanese carriers who had attacked Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. Then, of course, after the Hornet was sunk in October of 1942 at the Battle of Santa Cruz, which, again, a battle we'll hear from Merle Twible about, the badly damaged Enterprise was the lone carrier in the Pacific to fight the enemy. More than 400 men were lost on the Enterprise during the war, and the Enterprise's war record, including the shooting down of 911 planes, the sinking of 72 ships, and damaging or probably sinking another 192 ships, plus the destruction of shore facilities. So you could say that the Enterprise could say with pride that it had done the state and the United States some service, some great service during World War II. So on that note, I hope that gives a little context to what we're going to be talking about today with a sailor who brought such ingenuity, such matter-of-fact devotion to duty during his time on the USS Enterprise that I know you're going to be pleased, you're going to be impressed, you're going to be entertained by his stories this afternoon. We're going to do things a little bit different today. I'm going to take my first commercial break and then come back with some extended segments, some extended interviews with Merle Twible of Ivanhoe, 93 years young, and what a story he has to tell. You're going to hear every second of it today right here. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. My guest today, Merle Twible of Ivanhoe, is 93 years old. You wouldn't tell by looking at him, or if you see him riding his motorcycle from the top of California to the bottom of California, or vice versa, you certainly wouldn't guess that he's 93, but it's the truth. I've seen some evidence, and we're going to start at the very beginning. 93 years ago is a long time to remember back, but I understand your story starts somewhere on a farm in Kansas. Is that right?
Right. Well, I was born in Stockdale, Kansas, and I was number 9 of the 10 children in our family. Then, of course, back during the Depression days, why I was out and lived with my uncle in western Kansas, 29, 30, and 31, which during the Dust Bowl. And there was a lot of times that if it hadn't been for the old cow in the garden, why, we wouldn't have had anything to eat. But then I left there, went through the fourth grade in a country school out there. And by that time, my dad had got employment. He was worked for the Department of Justice. And I went back to Leavenworth, where I went through 2 years of ROTC at the high school. Well, that confirmed one thing. I didn't want to be in the Army. So then my dad had a selection to go to Alcatraz or McNeil Island, Washington. So we went to McNeil Island, and that was in Tacoma, Washington. Well, that was in 1934. And that winter, I didn't go back to school. I had 2 years of high school to finish, but I didn't go back to school. My sisters did. And I worked in a sawmill. Well, if you've ever worked in a sawmill in the state of Washington during the winter, you know why I went in the Navy in March of 1935.
And I don't think anybody would blame you for that. And I imagine in 1935, did you have any idea that there could be a war coming? Did you have a hint? I mean, I'm sure you had no idea of the things that you would face.
It was a matter of something to go where I could have a job and they would take care of me and I'd get everything furnished, and we got $17 a month in those days. But I went through training then in San Diego, California, and from San Diego, 3 months there, then I was transferred aboard the USS Roper, which was a DD-147. It was the old four-stack destroyers. And they was in what they call the rotating reserve, which meant that all they had, they was going into overhaul, and all they had was a skeleton crew. And that we spent the next 3 months then chipping bilges and painting red lead and getting the asbestos off the lines while we listed turbines and all those sort of things that today I understand is pretty serious business. But fortunately, I didn't have any problem. But then from the Roper, then I went to submarine school. I was a second-class machinist mate by that time. And I went to submarine school, and then where we found out that actually what we were there for as machinist mates, we were being trained as diesel mechanics because the entire fleet was shifting over to boats and everything to diesel engines. Well, that's when I ended up then on the Enterprise.
And to that point, you'd been on ships. The Enterprise is a little more than a ship. It is the most decorated ship in military history, no matter what country we're talking about. But this is more than a ship. That's a floating city. The first time you stepped on the Enterprise, were you blown away by how, I bet it was bigger than your hometown in Kansas.
Well, from the having been on the four-stack destroyer and then go on a ship that you could put the destroyer on one end of the hangar deck. But anyway, then I went on there and ended up that in the after engine room, and then from there I graduated to the A division and run the machine shop and had all the elevators and all the hydraulic equipment and training repair parties. And unless you've been on an aircraft carrier and see how big it is and how many different airlines, water lines, steam lines and everything, and these repair parties, which we had was repair 5, we had to learn where all of these valves were at during general quarters, and by our drills and the things that we did during peacetime paid off when the stuff started during the war.
And we're going to have plenty to talk about as far as what happened during the war, and I've seen a couple commendations with some pretty famous names on them as testimony to some of the things you were able to do. You talk about this repair work. How did you get so good with your hands? How did you get that mechanical instinct? Is that something that was developed back on the farm?
A lot of it was developed on the farm, but basically that was one of the best things when I went on the Roper that we had the skeleton crew, that it didn't make any difference that I was a new recruit and a fireman third class. There were certain things that I had to learn to do, run the evaporator, stand throttle watches, oiler watches, steering gear. And due to the fact that we didn't have any crew, Why, it didn't make any difference what you were. You learned to do it, and we'd get underway, and that was it. You'd do it.
And you'd have to keep doing it for a while. I want to fast forward a little bit, and we're talking to Merle Twibel of Ivanhoe, 93 years old. I know you can't tell by listening to him, but that is the truth. And I want to ask you about a date that I ask all our veterans about. But for you, I think it's going to be a little different answer. December 7th, 1941. A lot of times I'll talk to a veteran, and he was in high school, or he was coming back from church when he heard the radio broadcast. You were somewhere different, and you were a little closer to what was going on. Tell me what you remember about December 7th, 1941.
Well, the Enterprise, we went to Hawaii then in 1939, and we'd been there, of course, a couple of years, and we were on the way back from Wake Island, where we had delivered the Marine fighter planes. And on the way back, we were due at the sea buoy at 0600 on the Sunday morning. Well, we got into a storm, and the destroyers with us had to ballast back down again until, so it delayed our arrival back to Pearl Harbor until 1600 and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the sea buoy. Had we have been on time and hadn't stopped the fuel, the Enterprise would have been in Hospital Point, and we would have been blocked the whole Pearl Harbor probably, because that's what the Japanese were looking for, and they wonder where the hell are those aircraft carriers.
Now, what do you remember? I'm assuming you were probably below deck when things started happening, but what's the first you heard that there's some action going on, that there are some planes coming in, and that there might be something more than just exercises and maneuvers?
Well, what we heard, we got there and we heard something happen. We sent our air group in to Pearl, and we said, it's just another Sunday drill. So we did, and here we are, we're wasting time. We want to get in and go on Liberty. And then pretty soon, some of our air group come back, and they said, this ain't no drill. And several of them then got shot down. And from there on, well, it was a matter of general quarters and get ready. And then we went into Pearl, actually, then Monday night. And if you've seen that mess, why, that was something. Then we stayed about 4 hours and took on fuel and ammunition and food stuff, and then we got back out of there. And, of course, we knew about the little submarines by that time. And that we went through Hospital Point making about 25 knots. We threw a wake clear up over the top of the deal when we went out. It was something.
Well, and you just said if you saw what that looked like at that time, you'd never forget it. What did you see when you headed into Pearl Harbor? I'm sure you could see the smoke from the Arizona, but was it shocking to you? I mean, could you believe your eyes? Did you have any concept of how significant this was in the big picture?
Well, by that time, we knew what had happened, how many planes had attacked, and it was just one of those things that happens to you in a lifetime, and you look at it, and you wonder how we're going to get out. But we got out of there, and then we went looking for the Japs, and finally, fortunately, we didn't find them because we weren't ready for anything.
You'd have to wait a few weeks and months before that happened. I'm curious what your duties were at the time, and did you feel the same as any other day, or was there some adrenaline pumping? Were people panicking around you? What was the mood on the Big E, at least your section of it?
No, I had the machine shop and the elevators and all that, and it was just a matter of going to general quarters and still in the repair parties and drilling like we were and just waiting to see what would happen. And, of course, that's the whole idea of everybody out there was just after when we got back out of Pearl is to, we milled around out there, what's going to happen? We wait and see.
And, of course, a couple months later, you'd be back at Wake Island. 6 months later was the famed Battle of Midway, where the Big E did some major damage. During that time, as you had time to reflect on what had happened December 7th, did you have any clue as to how long this would be raging on? Could you look at it and say, we might be doing this for a few years?
Well, actually, we prepared then to go out and to the Marshall Islands and bomb them. Well, in the meantime, all the bombs they had aboard the Enterprise were armor-piercing bombs. So they went over and they borrowed a bunch of bombs from the Army. Well, I was, of course, had the machine shop, and after they got them aboard, well, then they found out that the Navy fuses wouldn't fit the Army bombs. So we were then, I and the rest of people in the machine shop, we spent the next 3 or 4 days of making adapters that so we could fit them into the bombs and screw our fuses on them. So we were pretty busy while we were headed for Wake Island and that. And then, of course, after we bombed the Marshall Islands and that, why they secured from general quarters, and we thought, well, that's fix the Japs. And of course, at that time, we felt that they couldn't see anyway. But while we were up there looking at the islands burn, all of a sudden there was two twin end Mitsubishis came out, and they almost got they hit this after the star or port quarters of the fantail of the ship, and they started a fire back there, kind of touched it with their wing. Well, that's when we learned that, hey, those guys will crash on you if they get a chance. We didn't think anybody would do that, but we found that out. And then, of course, after that, then it was a matter of days and days, just seeking in the Battle of Midway. And then, which we were rebricking some boilers and doing a lot of repair work during the Battle of Midway, and the Yorktown got sunk. And then we went back to Pearl, and then, of course, the rest of the war, which the next one was that I was in was Stewart Island.
Well, and you were in quite a few, and I don't want to gloss over what you just said there, and I know that you had a lot of different things to do, and when you're out there in the middle of nowhere on a ship, you can't call the next city for help. You got to do with what you have. You just talked about fixing these fuses. Now, the way I understand that, the whole possibility of bombing the enemy at that point rested in your fingers. You had to fix that fuse. Was there any pressure involved in that for you? I mean, did you feel that?
We had to make the adapters for the Navy fuses to fit the Army bombs.
How many times did you have to try to get it right, or is that something that you just nailed the first time?
Oh, no, we had the bomb right there, and we could measure the threads and all of that. And that it was kind of like an adapter on a pipe fitting where you take it, and that's all it were threads. And we had to make an internal thread where our bomb fuse would screw in, and the one would screw into the Army bomb, and that... Because what happened, they wanted these bombs to blow up above ground, not dig in the ground with our armor piercing. Because armor piercing, they'd just blow up a hole and that'd be it. And that was the reason they did it.
And I guess at that point, you'd probably gotten way past being nervous working around bombs. Is that anything that bothered you at first, the first time you had to work on a bomb?
No. Bombs and rockets and stuff on carriers and... 100-octane gas is just something you live with. And if you catch somebody smoking, you push them over the side.
I won't ask you if you actually had to do that or not. Tell you what, perfect spot for our first commercial break with Merle Twible, 93 years old. We'll be back with some of his heroics during the war. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm joined this week by 93-year-old Merle Twible of Ivanhoe. He's can still be spotted on his motorcycle if you look in the right direction. He's got a couple extra wheels on it these days, but that's just to be safe. And speaking of being safe, how would you like to be playing with bombs and 100-octane gas and fire on the deck of the most decorated ship in military history? The USS Enterprise was in 20 of the 22 major naval engagements during World War II. And I want to read you something, and then we'll ask Merle about it. And this is a commendation, a citation signed by Admiral William F. Bull Halsey. Back during World War II, it says, for exceptional courage and initiative in the performance of his duty under fire during engagement with Japanese naval forces near Santa Cruz Islands on October 26, 1942, in which his ship was heavily attacked by large numbers of enemy aircraft, Twible was at his station on the hangar deck when a bomb exploded on the third deck. With complete disregard for his personal safety, he immediately made his way forward through wrecked and burning planes on the hangar deck and directed the rescue of the men temporarily trapped in number one elevator pump room. With outstanding courage and initiative, he then rendered valuable assistance in the removal of bombs from planes on the hangar deck in the area of the fire. During a subsequent phase of the action, he was slightly wounded by a bomb fragment, but continued to render valuable aid on the hangar deck. His actions were in keeping with the highest traditions of the naval service. Sounds like October 26, 1942 was a memorable day for you.
Yes, that was the second real one. The first one with Admiral Nimitz was when we got the three bomb hits and lost steering and that. And that was in August. And, of course, there wasn't much time between August and October. But in in the August thing, we lost steering. And that's when I was Admiral Nimitz gave me credit for the modification that I had made to the rescue breathing apparatus. Was that any time you put it, you had to be in a room where the air was fresh and all that, and you would breathe into it and more or less kind of pump it up, when then the moisture in your warm breath would activate the oxygen in these cylinders and that breather would work. Well, what happened was that it had two lungs on the outside, and if you had a fire hose or you bumped into a compartment or a door or anything, well, you would knock the air out of this and you would have to come out into a clean air place to rejuvenate it. Well, I got the idea that in our training and all that, that we should have some kind of an air cylinder on there where we could replace it even down in the into wherever we were at. So we made up this little air flask and put 1,000 pounds of air in it. And when we, in the Stewart Island battle, or not, I guess it was, no, in August, the battle there when we had the three bomb hits back and we lost steering, well, I was headed with the repair parties back to get steering on when Chief Machinist Smith, my boss, came and caught me, and he says, "The captain has ordered me to the steering gear. Give me that breather you got on." So we went back out of the compartment, and he put that on, and he went down and got steering back on the ship. Well, when he come out, he agreed that he had reactivated that about three or four times. Otherwise, he would have had to come back out and activate it. So this is what got our steering back on the ship much quicker than if we had of not had this modification. So he got the Silver Star Navy Cross, and then at a later date, well, then I was commissioned a warrant officer, which I was happy with it. And that's when they said that I was credited with saving the ship, because what happened, we got back steering and we got out of there, and the Japanese knew we were running in a circle. And there was a group of planes come after us, but we were gone by the time they got there. And that's where they said I saved the ship. Well,
well, that's pretty impressive to save the most decorated military ship in history. And so basically, if you hadn't come up with that modification, the ship would have still been going in circles and the Japanese would have bombed the heck out of you. Tell me, you said you got this idea. Where'd you get that idea? Where did that? Were you just walking around and there was a light bulb moment, or where did that come from? Because I don't think I would have thought of that.
Well, I from the Roper and then to the Enterprise. Well, then I was in charge of Repair 5, and I had the machine shop, and it was just one of those things. And you just drill, because if you don't drill when the actual time comes, you don't perform. It's you have to practice to do it. And I've always been a kind of a, have an imagination to do things like that. So I just figured, you know, we need to fix this breather so that we can keep going whenever we start. If you knock the air out, why, we ought to be able to put it back. And we just took a piece of tubing and welded ends in it and tested it hydromatically, and then we could put 1,000 pounds of air in it and put it on the breather. And everybody in the repair party, I made them drill with it on, and they would have to go down and knock the air out, and then they would have to rejuvenate it so that we knew what we were doing down there. That's when you look at a ship, you can't imagine the amount of fire mains, steam lines, air lines, everything that has valves and that in it. Then you have to know where they're at. If you get damaged, you got to get the valves closed and get it. And if you don't drill during peacetime, why, you don't do it during war. But that was one of the things we always drill.
That sounds like a lot to remember to me. So you came up with this modification, and I have that citation too from Admiral Nimitz. It says, "For outstanding devotion to duty prior to, during, and after the attack on the USS Enterprise, he designed a valuable modification to the Type A rescue breather apparatus, which enabled personnel to accomplish emergency repairs, which otherwise would have been impossible. He cleared away debris and rendered invaluable assistance in the restoration of machinery during and after the attack of August 24, 1942. His conduct was inspiring. And like you said, they told you that you saved the ship, but someone else got a Silver Star and a Navy Cross. Did that ever bug you at all?
No. Chief Machinist Smith was my boss, and we worked together real good, and I looked at him, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a warrant officer and go up, and that's what I did. And like I told people, I retired as a lieutenant commander, and I was skipper of the biggest ship in the Navy, 100,000-ton floating dry dock. And I always looked up at the bridge, and I thought I'd like to be there till I got there. And then you turn around and you wonder, what am I doing here?
That sounds familiar, and I'm sure we'll touch on that. So that's what you did in August of 42, and I'm trying to put two and two together. I guess that means then you were using that same breathing apparatus on October 26th, 42, right, when we heard that description. Tell me about what happened that day at the Santa Cruz Island, because that sounds pretty intense to me.
Well, we were on by that time in August, this first-class machinist mate that I had on the hangar deck, he got hurt. He fell out of the elevator. He got electric wire in his ear and fell out of the elevator, and he went to the hospital. Well, that's then in October. That's why I was on the hangar deck, to fill in where he had always been filled in for me. And that was why I was up there, and that's the air officer on there. He used to look out, and we wore a certain color jersey, and he said, anytime I look out there, Twible, I want to see you.
I guess that's a good thing to hear. They feel secure with you. So you see a bomb go off, and your instinct is to run toward it and see who you can get out of there.
Well, we were steaming along, and the South Dakota was back on our starboard quarter, and there was a Destroyer Smith in between us and that. Well, there was a Japanese torpedo plane came in, and he thought if he'd come in between us, we wouldn't shoot at each other. And he came in between us and crashed on the destroyer finally, and we did. We shot right at each other, and that's not, I'm not so sure that I didn't have friendly fire in my back. I don't know. But we did. We were firing 40 millimeters right at each other to hit this Jap plane. And he crashed on the destroyer. And as the skipper of the destroyer then went back and made a real hard turn and got in our wake and got water over the bow and put the fire out on it. And about, it was a half hour later, I understand that he came back up and reported ready for action. But the South Dakota, one of the big, they put a bomb down on top of that their turrets, but that 18-inch armor on top of the turret, it just went off, that's all. It didn't hurt nothing. Except, I guess, the skipper up on the bridge got some when this bomb went off and hit the turret.
And somewhere in there, you find out that there are some guys trapped in the elevator pump room?
Well, yes, we got a bomb down through the bow, and it knocked all the big Healy-Shaw pumps or the elevator off their base and what have you, and I talked to them, and it was filled with smoke down there, so we went down, and we said, you start out, and we'll come down from the top. So it's down about six decks, and you got to open these watertight doors to get down there. So they started up, and we started down, and we got them out, and then that's went back, and that's when this aviation mech was there, and this one plane was on fire, and it had two 500-pound bombs on it. And you can only drop those bombs from inside the plane once it's put on there. So we asked him, do you know how to drop those bombs? And he said, yes, well, get in there and drop them. So he did. He dropped the two of them, and we rolled them over the side. And that's...
You know, they say you don't play with fire because you're going to get burned. That sounds an awful lot to me like playing with fire. You've got a raging fire, and you're trying to get these bombs away from it. Do you do that on your tiptoes or gingerly or just as fast as humanly possible?
You don't think, like I say, you do what you train to do. And you know you got to get this fire out because when you're aboard ship, if you don't get it out, you ain't going to have no place to live. So it's a little different than on the land where you can walk away from a building that's on fire. But aboard ship, you don't walk away from it. We don't get this out, we're in the water. So you have a reason to fight the fire.
A very good reason, a very compelling reason. And it's amazing to me, as you describe this, obviously, like you've said, you have to know your ship extremely well. It's clear that you knew it as well as anybody did. And the other thing that that Bull Halsey mentions in this citation, recognizing your actions on October 26, 1942, is that you were wounded with a bomb fragment. Tell me about that. What did you feel, and how did you figure out, and did you take time to stop for a second and see how bad it was, or did you just keep going?
Well, I knew I got it hit in the back. I wasn't sure what it was, and finally, this corpsman later on in the, during the day, he caught me and he said, "What's the matter? You're back." He said, "You're just blood from one end to the other," and so that's when they took me over. And what it was, then they pulled shrapnel out of my back. It was bleeding. But it was just, we had so much to do, and it wasn't really serious. It didn't, keep me from walking or doing anything. And but then how I got then the Purple Heart in 1947 aboard the Midway. Now, that's how long it took me to get a Purple Heart. Some people get them the next day, but I got mine in 1947 on the Midway.
And between October of 42 and 47, the Big E had a few more battles to fight. Did that mean anything to you to get the Purple Heart, or is it something that you never were too worried about?
Oh, I never worried about it. It was just one of those things that I knew I had it. And then this corpsman on the Midway, he got to looking, and he called me one day, and I was a lieutenant on there, and he called me, and he said, "Hey, did you ever get your Purple Heart?" And I said, "No, I didn't get one." So he took then the first thing why then we got... They had me up at quarters, and they sent me my Purple Heart, and they presented it, and 5 years later.
And at that point, the war was over, which I'm sure made it feel that much better. Well, we're moving through the show here with Merle Twible. Let's take another break, then we'll come back and hear if there are any other decorations he wants to share about. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. What a fascinating conversation today with Merle Twible of Ivanhoe, 93 years young. And I put the emphasis on young because he could run circles around me. You know, and we've been talking about his time in the war on the Big E, the USS Enterprise, the most decorated ship of World War II or any other war for that matter. And, you know, I'm just realizing, Merle, that October of 1942 is where we left off. At this point, most of the veterans I interview weren't even in the war yet, and you still had another almost 3 years to go in the war, another 5 years before you'd get that Purple Heart, as you told us about. What can you tell us about the rest of the war and how intense it was? Did you have any close calls? Is there anything that really sticks out and maybe that you're most proud of for what you and your fellow sailors did?
Well, then, then the Enterprise was scheduled to come back to the United States for overhaul the last part of 43. Well, by that time, I had just been promoted then to warrant and was ordered to Astoria, Oregon in the pre-commissioning detail for training of the 50 crews of the Kaiser carriers that they were building there. Well, then I got to Astoria, and Captain Barner was skipper there, and there was an electrician, myself, and another machinist off of the WASP. And he called the three of us over, and he said, "I'm going to the Shangri-La, and I'm going to take you with us." And we told him, "Well, we just got back, Captain. We've been out there since 39. And he said, "Well, I know, but we need your service." And he said, "In the meantime, the warrant billets are all filled on the Shangri-La, so we're going to promote you to ensign, and you're going anyway." So that's how I ended up on the Shangri-La, and then we went right back out, and I was back for the rest of the war on the Shangri-La. Then after the war, of course, then I spent time in Europe, a year on the Midway. I spent a year out in China on the Pollux and AKS, and then I came back from there, and right after the war, I was on the Cape Gloucester, and we hauled Marines and everything back to the States during that time. And then when I went to the Logan, an APA 196, well, then I had to go down to San Diego and go to P1 school. Well, that's where I found out also I didn't want to be a Marine, because we had to go over the side and get into an M-boat that's jumping up and down 4 and 5 feet. But if you'd never been in amphibs, when you go there, you got to go down and go to P1 school and find out how the Marines live. And from that, but then from there, that's when I went to Pearl Harbor and went to the inactive floating dry dock group. And at that time, then I was ordered over to reactivate the FDB-1 and took it to Guam. And then when we got to Guam, why then I finished that, went over as skipper of the FDM-8, which was commensurate with my rank. It was a cruiser dock.
Well, and sorry to rip the microphone away from you here, but I want to ask you now. You just said skipper, and you describe all this so matter-of-factly because you've lived it. But I think for us trying to grasp your story, it's a little impressive, a little surprising, a little incredible what you've accomplished here. 2 years of high school in Kansas. You're in the Navy from 1935 on. Was there a point along the way where you're just one of the guys on this ship of thousands that you thought, you know what, one day I wouldn't mind being the skipper of a ship? Did you think that was possible in 1935 or 36, 37? And once you actually were in command of a U.S. Navy ship, what was that feeling like for you?
Well, that's what I say. Way back on the Roper, when I first come out of training station, I always remember our skipper on there was a lieutenant commander, 2.5 stripes on his sleeve. And as I went on down the road, I always remembered that he was a lieutenant commander. And I just, I don't know, it just came natural. And finally, I went up and got to be skipper, and I graduated slowly, and I think I earned my way. And every time I could get a school, it didn't make any difference what it was. Boiler turbines, damage control, uniform code of military justice, Navy regs, anything, and then navigation in Pearl Harbor. And it was just, I wanted to be there, and like I said, I felt good on it. I felt I could do it because I had the years and the training to do the part, and I was certainly knew how to set an example to the crew because I had lived with them all those years. And if you don't set an example, then they won't follow you. But if you set an example, that they follow.
Well, this is what I love about doing this show, the pearls of wisdom that I get to pick up. And we just heard a big one right there. And I'm sure that your crew respected you more because of what you had been through and been with them by their side. Now, this is a difficult question for you. And I believe, even at 93, if you were the skipper of a ship, I'd jump on that ship just listening to you talk. But of all the years that you spent in the Navy, is there one thing that you're most proud of that when people say, thank you for serving our country, thank you for serving in World War II and all your years in the Navy, but what's that all about? What are you most proud of as far as your service to our country?
Oh, I would think that the number of ships that I was chief engineer of, and that three of them I had to decommission. The first one I put out of commission, it took about 3 months. And if you ever took a ship and dried all the water out of it and cleaned all the dirt out of it and everything, and from the first one I put out, well, that's when I got a good fitness report from it, and it ended up then I had to put two more of them out, the Cape Gloucester and the Logan. But I just think, and one of the things that I always look back on was that you have the U.S. Naval Academy people that come from there, but they really treated us, we call Mustangs, because we took a lot of jobs that I'm sure they didn't want anyway. Like, they didn't want to be the dry dock because they wanted to be CNC of the fleet and that sort of thing. And I'll say one thing, that the Academy people really treated us nice. I mean, and when we would come through as chief engineer of a ship and that, and they were up on the bridge, we really got along good.
There are a couple other questions that I just have to ask you before I wrap up this visit. One, of course, and I ask a lot of veterans this, and most of them have some pretty good examples of why they felt this way. Was there ever a day, and you were in the war from the beginning until the end, was there ever a day in there where you felt like, this might be my last day? I don't know if I'm coming back from this battle. I don't know if this ship's going to be around at the end of the day. Maybe there are a lot of days like that, but when you find yourself in that situation, how do you deal with it? How do you keep going, and how do you move forward?
I don't think I ever thought of that. It was just another day, and you're standing four on and eight off watches, and you've always got something to do. And if you're off watch and you got anything broke down while you're working, it's just 24 hours a day is just filled up. I don't think it ever bothered me. You just cuss a little bit and say, wish they'd get this over with, and that's it. You know you got to do it, and that's, you just live with it.
And I can tell you've been living that way ever since. You know, this is not the first time that you've talked about your service, and I think people at home can tell that that you know what you're talking about. These memories are still clear. You've been on the History Channel talking about the Big E. I know that you've shared some of your experiences and those of those around you with a lot of people. Why do you think that's important? Why is it important to talk about the things that happened so long ago? And if you have a chance to share with someone what World War II and what the Navy in particular did during that time, what that's all about, what's that number one message that you want to get across?
Well, I think it makes us feel real good that we know that somebody is appreciating what we did. It was a long time, and it, like I say, four on and eight off and work in between time. And then you end up in a place here like today, and somebody comes in and they appreciate what you did. It makes you feel good. And you know you don't have too much more time, but it's you look at it and you just like to have somebody recognize you. That's all.
Well, that's what this program is about, and we are so grateful for your service to our country and for talking a little bit about it. I've got to ask you, with all that time that you spent on the open seas, how do you like being in the middle of an orange grove in Ivanhoe? And is that a bit of a contrast for you?
Well, that's, of course, since 1904, that's when I lost Mickey. That was my superior around here and told me what to do. So I, a lot of times I just sat here, but I'm just real happy that the way she saved and everything and my surroundings, and I don't have to worry about anything. I take the dogs for a walk, and I'm just real happy.
God's been good to you. That much is clear. And one last question for you. I have heard that for years, and you can tell me the details, that you take a motorcycle ride from the California-Mexico border way up north, and even at 93 years old, you're still planning to do this. Tell me about this, and why do you do that?
No, I did that for 10 years, which we call the Three Flags Classic. You go down to Mexico, and you leave there, and you got 3 days to get to a ski resort in Canada. And so you're riding 1,500 miles a day, and then you can rest a little bit and then get back on your bike and go again. Well, in the meantime, they give you a route to go, and they warn you that we may even change the route in the meantime. So you better follow this route. And the only time you're on the freeway is when you cross it. But anyway, this year I sent in my money, and my name wasn't drawn. They only have so many, they pull a number for the ski resort where they're going. But the guy called me, and he says, "Hey, Merle, we get you a ticket if you want it." And I said, "No. My kids, I know, I talked to them, and I've said, I've thought of this, and I know I sent in my money, but I figured maybe that I would decide not to go. But now that I said you didn't draw my name, I said, I just think about it, and I've got to remember that I'm 93, and I ride my bike down to Bakersfield and that, and I don't think I'm ready for 1,500 miles. So I have, on my own, and I've made my kids very happy to say, no, I'm not going this year.
Did you go last year?
Yes, I went last year.
Do you think that's a record? Do you think 92 is the oldest person to complete that race on a motorcycle?
Oh, I was the oldest guy up there for the last 5 years. And there was one guy that came, and he would always come in, and then when he'd see me there, oh, what the hell, are you here again?
Well, maybe he'll be a happy camper this year that you're not there.
Well, that's, I sent word to him last year when I said, I won't be there. Good luck to you. You can be the old guy this year.
What a gracious decision on your part. Well, thank you so much, as I said, for serving our country so bravely, so uniquely, and with such ingenuity that I don't know if we've ever heard some of these stories on this program before. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap this up?
No, my end was that I was a materiel officer of the Long Beach Reserve Fleet Group, which we had dry docks and 50 D-Day destroyers down there. And I was down there, and then I decided that I was going to retire, and the detail officer in the Bureau called me And he said, I don't know why you're retiring. You're going to be on the list for three-striper here. And I said, well, where am I going if I go? And he said, well, first you'll probably go to Monterey for 6 months. And then he said, I think you'll probably go as exec of an APA. And I said, I'm going to retire.
Well, it doesn't sound like you've regretted that decision one bit. And we can tell that you've been very busy. And who knows, maybe Merle's going to decide to get back on his bike next year and do that race. You can wave to him when he rides by here in the Valley. It's been a great pleasure today visiting with Merle Twible of Ivanhoe. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.